To hear previous Making Waves shows, please visit our archive online at freewebs.com/SPRAV/audio.htm. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of our show, or if you'd like to volunteer to work with us. And feel free to call the station in the next hour for more info, 430-9722. Now, for some people's history. Coming up this week, on July 12th, is the birthday of Pablo Neruda. Born in Chile in 1904, Neruda was a poet and a revolutionary. His poems reflect his commitment to social justice and solidarity. I'll let his own words speak for him with, "So is my life." My duty moves along with my song. I am not. That is my destiny. I exist not if I do not attend to the pain of those who suffer. They are my pains. For I cannot be without existing for all who are silent and oppressed. I come from the people and I sing for them. My poetry is song and punishment. I am told you belong to darkness. Perhaps, but I walk toward the light. I am the man of bread and fish, and you will not find me among books, but with women and men. They have taught me the infinite. 1 year ago, on July 9th, 2004, the International Court of Justice, ICJ, issued an advisory opinion that the wall Israel is building in the occupied Palestinian West Bank is illegal and must be torn down. The ICJ also ruled that countries cannot provide aid or assistance to Israel to maintain the wall. 1 year after this historic ruling, not only has Israel refused to implement the ICJ opinion, but the United States remains in noncompliance with it as well. The U.S. campaign to end the occupation urges people to take action by contacting the State Department, White House, and your members of Congress to demand that the U.S. comply with the International Court of Justice opinion and stop providing Israel with aid to maintain the wall. Please see www.endtheoccupation.org for more information. On July 15, 2002, 150 women from a Nigerian village took over the neighboring Chevron Texaco oil terminal, demanding electricity, roads, schools, hospitals, and a more equitable distribution of the wealth from the oil extracted from their country by the multinational corporation. The weapon they used to gain access to the terminal was the threat to disrobe, which is a huge insult in their culture. And in the end, the oil giant agreed to their demands. Here's a song from Bev Grant telling their story.
From shack to shack, from dugout to new, across and back, the rivers and creeks that cross the land, the women of Okoroto lay the plan. Around the corner, women are coming. Around the corner, women are coming. Around the corner, women are coming. Around the corner, women are coming.
Hundreds of women gathered by the riverfront before sunrise on July 8th. They watched the Chevron boat approach the dock to take their men to work that day. It took the captain by surprise when the women came on board and left the men behind. Sailing past the Chevron docks, they set foot on company grounds for the very first time.
Woman to woman, shack to shack, from dugout canoe up across and back, the rivers and creeks that cross the land, the women of Okoroto took a stand.
Round the corner, women are coming. Round the corner, women are coming. Round the corner, women are coming. Round the corner, women are coming.
Well, you
that was The Women Are Coming by Bev Grant. And now for Tom Jackson's interview with John Hudson.
We're talking with Dean Hudson, dean of the Franklin Pierce Law School. And Dean Hudson is involved with a lawsuit against Donald Rumsfeld. Dean Hudson, could you give us a basic synopsis of what the lawsuit is about and who the various players in the lawsuit are?
Sure. The lawsuit is brought by eight plaintiffs who are former detainees who were captured either in Iraq, foreign Iraq, or in Afghanistan, who were later released and complained of having been tortured. And if you were to read the pleadings, it really is, their experiences were quite horrific. They're being represented by the ACLU and by an organization known as Human Rights First, and my role is to be of counsel, the expression that's used in legal parlance, to Human Rights First.
Can you give the listeners an idea of, you know, you say that the torture and so on, the descriptions are pretty horrific. You know, can you give people an idea of what we're talking about?
We're talking about things like sodomy with broom handles and waterboarding long periods of sensory deprivation, where you lose sense of time and space and those kinds of things. So that, you know, there are, definitions vary, and perhaps one definition that some of torture, you know, depending on the individual, but it is clearly cruel, inhuman, and degrading, which is another category.
What is waterboarding?
Waterboarding is when you put people underwater and give them the sensation that they're going to drown, or you cover their faces with wet rags so that they suffocate, and then, you know, just at the point that they're about ready to black out, you let them up. So what happens is that, from my point of view, I guess, my judgment, you know, I spent 28 years in the United States Navy, and I have a strong sense, I guess I'd say, of the importance of the chain of command and to the chain of command of accountability. And there never has really been, I don't believe, any real accountability. You know, we have pointed to the so-called few bad apples. We've prosecuted the lower-ranking enlisted people, which we surely should be doing. I mean, they are bad apples. There's no question about that. But I think that there's more to it than that. And the administration, although they've conducted a number of investigations, the investigations were not intended and did not look up at all. They only looked down towards the few bad apples. Congress has taken a pass on this, so we turned as a last resort to the judicial system and to the court in an effort to cause somebody to look at what really happened, what were the root causes of the problem, not just the symptom of the disease, the manifestation of the problems, the awful things that happened to people, but what caused those problems. Because I think it's important for the United States to, in a very courageous kind of way, take a hard look at that so that we can fix the problems in the future.
What, in your opinion, did cause the problems?
Well, I don't know for sure. That's part of the point of this, I guess. You know, that I think that there are potentially problems with recruiting, with leadership, with supervision, with training, you know, with the role of contractors in all of this. You know, there is the potential there, and I think, in fact, in some respects, there are organic, systemic issues that cause what happened to happen. You know, people didn't just come up with these ideas on their own. And remember, too, Tom, we're looking at over 100 deaths, 28 of which the Army itself has identified as the result of criminal activity. There are literally hundreds of examples of abuse of detainees. And serious abuse, not just, you know, they had to stay up past their bedtime kind of abuse, but, you know, serious kinds of things that ultimately can result in death. And for us to not acknowledge it, not deal with the real problem, I think, is asking for these things to happen again. And that's what I want very much not to happen. You know, I want to figure out what went wrong, whether it's, you know, recruiting, leadership, training, supervision, whatever, and then fix it. But we haven't done that yet. You know, we've continued to say, well, it's a few bad apples, and we'll court-martial the junior enlisted people and dust ourselves off and say we've dealt with it. And I don't think we really have, not in a meaningful way.
In looking at your bio on the Franklin Pierce Law School website, I was really struck by, you know, your credentials and your background. And it seems to me, you know, there couldn't be too many other people with the sort of depth of background that you have in both the legal field and in military service. If you wanted a sort of ideal lawyer on this case, it seems to me you've got that background. Can you give people, you know, I know it's a lot of stuff, but maybe a brief brief synopsis of what you've done.
Well, I went in the Navy in January of 1973 after law school with no particular intention of staying in, but I just really, really enjoyed it, and I felt good about what I was doing. I felt good about the mission. I felt like I was spending my professional life in a worthwhile way. I lived all over the United States, lived in Italy, did all kinds of jobs from court martials to teaching to lobbying Congress, which is one of the things I like, a whole range of responsibilities. And then in 1997, I was selected to be the Judge Advocate General of the Navy, which I a job I held for 3 years, and then retired in 2000 and came here to be the Dean of the Frank Pierce Law Center.
In looking, you know, at the subject matter of this lawsuit, it seems to me that, you know, you're dealing with something, looking at it from not just a, you know, layperson's sort of perspective, but from the perspective of the public in the United States today, there's such a division. You know, you've probably got half of the public that's saying, or maybe less than half, but a lot of people still who would say, well, you know, this is just the way it's got to be because we were attacked on 9/11 and we've got to, you know, we've got to nail these bad guys. And also a very significant amount of people who are saying, this is a nightmare. This is what we never wanted our country to be. And here we are. And, you know, we're doing these things. Has that sort of division, of the public affected, your life, your work, in any way, or are you just pretty much full ahead with this whole thing?
Well, that's an excellent question. Now, I'm pretty much full ahead with it, but, I have a keen understanding of the people on the so-called other side of the issue. And what I wish I could do is sit down with each of them or in small groups and explain what it is I'm trying to do here. I have an abiding love for the United States Armed Forces and naturally for the country. I dedicated the best part of my life to serving it. And I believe that what I'm doing is continuing that service. And I think that we all agree that we need to win this war, however you define the war on terror. The question is, what does winning mean? And I believe that if we don't, you know, take stock of ourselves and take a hard look at how we're prosecuting the war, we very much run the risk of stepping off the high road and going down the slippery slope to the low road. And if we do that, if we commit the same, the kinds of misdeeds that we have been critical of other countries for having committed in the past, then we won't have won. We will have lost the war because, you know, winning or losing isn't going to be defined the way we defined winning and losing in the great world wars, for example. So that I think it's important for us, particularly now when there's the temptation to do otherwise, to be absolutely sure that we really exercise due process and support the rule of law that this country has stood for generations. And if we stop doing that because of how awful the enemy is, then we will have lost something very significant. And, you know, it's not a rule of law if you only apply it when it's convenient. And so if we really stand for the rule of law, if that's one of the things we're fighting for, and support human rights, then we have to do it all the time. We can't just do it some of the time. And we can win this war and still do that and protect our troops in the future, which is one of the things that concerns me very much, is the kinds of problems that we're seeing, the misdeeds that have been done, in the long run, are going to serve to hurt United States Armed Forces in the future. And I think that is a very dangerous and a very bad thing for us to let happen.
Who are the defendants in the case? I assume it's not just Donald Rumsfeld.
Well, no, indeed it is. It's just Donald Rumsfeld.
Okay.
Now, there is another case going on which I am not involved with, which involves certain senior military people, Sanchez, General Sanchez, and others. I felt very strongly and was able to convince the ACLU and Human Rights First, who also agreed with me on this, that in many respects we are simply trying to make the point that there is accountability up the chain of command and that the civilian leadership is ultimately responsible. That's the way the Constitution is set out. And that rather than dragging in a bunch of uniformed officers, the point can be made by simply suing Secretary Rumsfeld. And so that's what we decided to do.
And what stage is the lawsuit at this point?
The lawsuit has been removed from Chicago, which is Secretary Rumsfeld's hometown, to Washington, D.C., and there will be a motion to dismiss that the judge in the U.S. Federal District Court in Washington will address, and presuming we get past that, then we'll go on to discovery.
What's the crux of the defense's argument?
Well, we haven't really gotten into the merits of that yet. What we've been doing up to now has all been procedural, removing the lawsuit and so forth to Washington. I expect the crux of the suit will be that any actions he took in his official capacity so that he can't be sued because it would interfere with the prosecution of the war and all of that sort of thing. You know, he doesn't have time for it kind of thing. It is, as I said a moment ago, it is only with great reluctance and as a last resort that we end up in the court system. You know, I would much prefer to have these questions answered through an independent investigation. And I have been asking for that. I've called for it. I'm on record saying that we ought to do that. But neither the administration nor Congress has been willing to do that. So although we've got 11 or 12 investigations going on, they're not really looking at the serious systemic problems that may exist within the armed forces and the chain of command.
It was a fairly widely publicized, I guess it was a memo from Alberto Gonzalez that came out a few months ago, in which, arguably anyway, he sort of seemed to be giving the green light to the torture, to the government using torture. I guess this was a memo to George W. Bush. Is that something that's likely to play into this lawsuit, or is that not likely?
Well, I think it's part of it in the sense that that was the first, or certainly one of the first steps, you know, down that slippery slope when the administration, including the Department of Defense, decided that we would define torture very, very narrowly. That's the memo you're talking about, to include only that degree of pain which would result in death or permanent organ damage. We would define the defenses to torture very, very broadly, and we would say that the Geneva Conventions don't apply. So that, you know, all of those things taken together, I think, were a large part of how we ended up where we are when the Department of Defense accepted those recommendations.
And, of course, there was also that statement that the Geneva Conventions and the sort of tenets of those conventions are now quaint, I think the word was. What's your feeling about that? I mean, to me, that seems really arrogant, but, you know, what's your feeling about it?
I think it was a huge mistake. You know, they are the Geneva Conventions, and the United States was the prime mover in the wake of World War II in enacting the Geneva Conventions and ensuring that we fought wars to the extent you can fight a war according to rules, that we would fight wars according to rules. And remember, it's the United States who has the most to lose when you say the Geneva Conventions are outdated and quaint. Because it's the United States that is more forward deployed. It's our forces who are in harm's way more than all the other countries combined. So that if we pick and choose when the Geneva Conventions are going to apply, that means that essentially that every other country can pick and choose when they want to apply the Geneva Convention, and they may often pick to not apply the Geneva Convention when they have U.S. soldiers in custody. And that was my great concern about that. So that I think that it was legally wrong, but perhaps even more importantly, I think it was morally, diplomatically, and militarily a very bad, short-sighted, ill-conceived memo.
My next question, and I apologize if you've already answered this, but I definitely hear a clear statement in terms of a moral sort of result that you're looking for out of this lawsuit. But what exactly is the legal, you know, redress or relief that you're looking for or hopeful for to come out of this?
Yeah, the relief that they're looking for is monetary compensatory damages, you know, money, simply for their injuries as a result of the torture, not, no punitive damages or anything like that, and for a declaration that Rumsfeld is responsible for, what happened to them. And there are a couple of legal theories by which I believe that's true, you know, that, there's lawsuits, trials, Bivens versus unknown agents is one case in which government actors can be held responsible for the things that they do under the cloak of their governmental position. And there is a case by the name of Yamashita in which after World War II we held a Japanese general responsible for the activities of his subordinates in the Philippines that he permitted to happen. The United States didn't demonstrate that he knew or should have known, but that he was responsible and it happened on his watch. And that's the key. You know, these things happened under Secretary Rumsfeld's watch, and he then bears some responsibility for them. And so that's kind of the legal theory upon which the thing is pinned.
I have a more general question about the legal system. I do a lot of public speaking about international issues, and often when people will ask, you know, what do you think should be done to change things, among many sort of different aspects that I go into, whether it's changing the way we do business with the rest of the world or whatever, I will often talk about the development and the U.S. participation in the development of international law. And with this administration, it seems to me that they're on a dead run in the opposite direction. You know, taking our signature off the charter for the ICC and things like that. For listeners who are skeptical that the legal system is a path or a viable path for dealing with problems that arise that are done by our government, our high government officials, defend that. That idea, if you would, you know, that this is really a viable path and that a constructive one.
I think that you know, the world is watching, and that when history is written about the global war on terror, much of what is written will be dedicated to the questions of how the United States fought that war. And if we have turned a blind eye, if we ignore international law, if we ignore the Geneva Convention, if we ignore the Convention Against Torture, if we ignore even our own domestic law, for example, Article 93 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which makes criminal abuse of individuals under your authority, control, like detainees, if we throw all those laws and traditions over the side and ignore them because, as Attorney General Gonzalez said, this is a new paradigm. You know, this is unlike any war we've ever fought. Then I think if we do those things, if when history is written, the United States' reputation is going to suffer. And I think it suffers right now on the international scene. You know, that our allies, our historical allies, think less of us as a result of what's happened. And that's going to make it very difficult for the United States in the future to coalesce coalition of countries, militaries, in our future wars. You know, the natural way to fight wars in the future is going to be through alliances. And countries are going to be less willing to fight alongside us if we do this. The other thing about it, I think, is that we're the strongest nation on earth, and that's almost become a mantra now. I believe that it is true. But we're the strongest nation on earth, not just because of our great military strength, but because of our economy and because of our essential island nature, but also, significantly, we're the strongest nation on earth because of our mission, that we have, over the years, over the generations, supported the rule of law and supported human rights. And it's that, I use the word righteousness, that gives us great strength. We are the world leader because of that, not because we've got the strongest military. And so if we lose that, we will have lost, I believe, our greatest weapon. You know, we won't be as strong as we otherwise could be. We won't have the influence among other nations that we would otherwise have, because we no longer quite stand for the support of human rights and the rule of law that we once stood for. And I think that would be a great tragedy. And that's why I think it's important for us to get back on track.
What's the title of the case?
Ali et al. Versus Rumsfeld.
Well, I wish you the best with it.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks to Tom Jackson for that interview with John Hutson, Dean and President of Franklin Pierce Law School, and of counsel on the legal team of former detainees suing Donald Rumsfeld. Here's a song by David Rovix, After We Torture Our Prisoners.
We'll get rid of the dictator, rebuild your country, make sure all your kids go to school. We'll clean up the cities, get the sewage plants running, institute parliamentary rule. We'll bring you autonomy, senators and judges, and a shiny new blue banner. We'll bring you pride and prosperity, food in your bellies, and every home a phone, fax, and scanner. After we torture our prisoners, we'll bring you decades of peace, spiritual release, free religious expression. You can say what you want in the papers you run, we'll never force a confession. After we torture our prisoners, the oil will flow just where it should go, across the desert and into the sea. You'll thank your God and the CIA that finally you are free. After we torture our prisoners, you'll all be safe with us to protect you and keep you out of harm's way. You'll thank creation and your liberation from the dark into a new day. After we torture our prisoners, you can all jump for joy, each girl and boy, and look boldly into the distance. You'll be so happy for all that we've done, for such invaluable assistance. After we torture our prisoners, you won't have to worry about tyrants and bullies, now that you have sovereignty. You can hold your head high, kiss Saddam goodbye, say hello to democracy. After we torture our prisoners, after we torture our prisoners.
Next, we have a couple of commentaries about occupation. The first appeared in Haaretz, called Addicted to Occupation, by Bradley Burstyn. At first, it was all about freedom, the addiction that now goes by the names Greater Israel, or Occupation, or more commonly, Our Reality. Felt nothing like a disease at first. It felt, in fact, nothing like occupation. It felt free. Before the first real taste of occupation, 19 years of statehood seemed to have made Israel into the world's largest ghetto. Choked by recession, slowly strangled within borders that only barely repelled neighbors bent on annihilation of their country, hundreds of thousands of Israelis had survived the Holocaust only to be facing what appeared to be a new one in 1967. The first dose hit like medicine, like manna, like deliverance. As is true of many narcotics, occupation at first granted a kind of weightlessness to people who had suffered all their lives from an excess of gravity. There was a sudden sense of empowerment, of limitless room to move, of unaccustomed safety. What no one knew then was what every addict comes to discover, often too late. You don't have any idea that you're addicted until you face the pains of withdrawal. We were no different from other addicts. We thought we could stop any time we wanted, so we didn't. If someone asked questions, wondering about the wisdom of endless occupation, the heavy users, the pushers of occupation, derided them, questioned their manhood, called them names like Rakruchi, Softy, or Yefei Nefesh, Bleeding Heart, a suggestion that one was less potent, latently homosexual, or both. Like other addicts, our first instinct, when the pangs and the nausea and the cramps and the searing pains of withdrawal began taking effect, was to medicate with more of the drug, to settle further, to reoccupy, to fantasize anew, as the pushers and the heavy users of yeshiva and yeshivas abroad had never stopped doing, about the drug as a means for spiritual enlightenment, of ultimate fulfillment of the destiny of man. And, like other addicts, we were not about to stop until we hit rock bottom. Have the Palestinians hit rock bottom? Not yet. Have the Israelis? Not nearly. But, at the risk of being dismissed as weak-willed by my heavy user brethren, I confess that rock bottom is where I am. So this is my first meeting of Occupiers Anonymous. I am new here, and distinctly uneasy. I have protected settlers in the northern Sinai, in southern Gaza, and the length of the West Bank. I have occupied Lebanon and the Golan. I have occupied every territory it was possible to occupy. I am an occupier, and I want to stop. In the past, I blamed my failure to stop occupying on the settlers who manufactured new occupations and on the leaders who enabled them. I blamed my failure on the Palestinians who missed no opportunity to misread the Israelis. I blamed my failure on the terrorists who destroyed any chance of ending the occupation because their very self-image and power depended on an occupation without end. But this summer, I decided to begin the 12 steps. God, grant me the serenity to leave the places I can leave. Give me the courage to stand and defend the places I should, and the wisdom to know the difference. That was Addicted to Occupation, printed in Haaretz. Next, I have a commentary called Stopping the Addiction that I wrote for nhindymedia.org. Never mind that the invasion of Iraq was justified with lies or the huge profit motives for war that exist, particularly for high officials in the Bush administration. Their predictions of the ease of the war were naive at best and lies at worst. Remember, the war will pay for itself, very few troops will be needed, and we'll be welcomed with flowers, it will be a cakewalk, etc. How long has it been since the mission was declared accomplished? And since then, the Iraqi resistance has only grown in size, skill, and sophistication, largely thanks to the brutality, arrogance, and bureaucratically indifferent incompetence of Bush and his cronies. At a recent press conference, Bush said, "The terrorists want us to do what a growing number of GOP leaders are calling for, setting some sort of timetable, years long, for U.S. withdrawal from Iraq." Bin Laden has said that he wants to suck us into occupying a Middle Eastern country, the better to mobilize against and destroy America's ability to dominate the world. George and Osama want things to carry on as they are, while lawmakers who care about their re-election see an exploding resistance movement in Iraq, an unprepared and heavily infiltrated Iraqi army, growing U.S. casualties, a majority of Americans critical of the occupation, and no end in sight. Bush cannot admit defeat, although that is exactly what is already a foregone conclusion in Iraq. They lost somewhere between scoffing at the notion of nation-building, claiming that a few U.S. soldiers with high-tech weapons could competently occupy a vast country of 23 million people, and continuing the Saddam legacy of repression and torture at Abu Ghraib, throughout Iraq, and elsewhere. George Bush, in his life of luxury, feels no motivation or sense of urgency to cut our losses, and we have already lost a lot. George will continue to fight for his political life by continuing the hopeless, illegal war that kills U.S. soldiers and the Iraqi people en masse on a daily basis until the American people force him from office and into the quiet life of obscure disgrace he so richly deserves. You can find that commentary with citations on nhindymedia.org.
Thanks to Steve Diamond for bringing us those commentaries on occupation. To further mark the one-year anniversary of the ICJ, International Court of Justice, ruling that the wall Israel is building in occupied Palestine is illegal. Here's a song from David Rovix called They're Building a Wall.
They're building a wall, a wall between friends, a wall that justifies any means for their ends, a wall between Semites, rich and poor, brothers and sisters from not so long before. Many feet thick and 20 feet high, no one can look through it and into the eye of a person you might know, to whom you might confide. Now just a stranger on the other side. They're building a wall between water and land, so we can eat fruit and they can eat sand. A wall to make sure that our orchards will grow and our kids can get fat and not need to know of the cities in ruins and the children in fear that your fathers and brothers and tanks might be near. A wall to keep quiet that which you fear most, so you don't have to listen to your grandfather's ghost. They're building a wall between future and past, a wall to keep distant the chambers of gas from the bulldozers' gunships and the tears of a child. Dignity, love, and all honor defiled, to remove reality from your facts on the ground. A wall to keep distant the terrible sound of the houses that crumble and the children that die. A wall to keep separate the truth from the lie. Such a cost, land, money, and safety, and all the lives lost. A wall made of brick, but bricks can be broken when the people of Zion have finally awoken and said no more walls, no more refugees. Someday recall, before apartheid was ended, they were building a wall.
Hiram a little, Hiram, 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 Hiram slavery. I do remember, that's why I believe. I don't know why the rivers overflow their banks. I don't know why the snow falls and covers the
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with I Remember, I Believe. It followed David Rovix's song, They're Building a Wall. Thanks for listening to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Diamond, Brian Gregg, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Adam Meyerowitz, Dino Pappas, Joanne Paradise, Damon Thomas, and Jeff White. We welcome and need your participation, too. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you're not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program when we plan on exploring media issues. We leave you today with this quote by Abraham Lincoln. The best way to destroy an enemy is to make him a friend.